Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Today, we continue with our coverage of the Santa Fe Film Festival, which opens on Wednesday, the 3rd of December, and runs through Sunday, December 7th. I'd like now, we're going to have all sorts of filmmakers on the air today. I'd like to welcome David Modigliani. He is the producer and director of the documentary Crawford. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
So you made a documentary about Crawford, Texas, the home, in quotes, I guess, of George W. Bush. It's not really where he's from. Tell us a little bit about Crawford and how George W. Bush chose that as a place to live.
I think you're right to put home in quotation marks. The then Governor Bush in 1999 purchased a ranch in Crawford shortly before he announced his candidacy for president. As a history teacher in the film, a Crawford history teacher says she thinks he needed a place to be from, a place to create a sort of folksy small town image, which is what his subsequent presidential campaign really focused on. And my impetus for making the film was when I found out that he actually wasn't from Crawford, that he had moved there just before his run for the presidency. I think his communication staff did such a fantastic job of creating that image, that sort of origin myth of a guy from Crawford, Texas, that many of us don't know that he's actually not from there. So we chose to focus on this tiny 700-person, one-stoplight town that was thrust into the national spotlight when Bush moved in.
What was it like before Bush moved in, and how did it change upon his arrival?
Well, this was a very sleepy, very quiet town, had become actually quite economically depressed. Most of the stores were boarded up. The day that Bush announced he was moving to Crawford, every store on Main Street was bought or rented in a single day. After he won the presidency, the high school band went and played at the inauguration. The Baptist pastor called it a miracle. And as we see early on in the film, this was a real thrill for the very conservative community of Crawford to have the Republican president be their new neighbor.
At the same time, there is a difference in the image of Crawford that the Bush people put forth and the reality of Crawford that the people in your documentary are pretty hip to. And there's a level of maybe cynicism is too strong a word, at least on the part of some of the people, but they'll say things like, oh, yeah, he chops down trees as long as the cameras are rolling.
Exactly. I think after that initial boom of excitement, the people from Crawford started seeing themselves on the national news, and they saw that every single stand-up done by the news reporters was in front of the same backdrop, which is a bale of hay and a broken-down piece of farm machinery. And they knew that this was actually 8 miles from the Bush Ranch, and if the camera would just pan a little bit to the right, you would see the high school track. So they felt that they were made to look a lot more podunk and hillbilly and backward than they really were, that this was an image that the Bush communication staff and the media itself wanted to convey. And so, yes, I think they did become aware of the ways in which these political narratives are crafted and perhaps the way in which their town was being used as a set or a stage for this political narrative.
It is interesting to see a fairly conservative town, and we say fairly conservative, we'll get into that in a moment, it's not a purely conservative town, but to see it being politicized in this way, people become aware of how the spin machine works, and there's a wonderful teacher whom you feature in the film who is doing, you know, pretty much the Socratic method of teaching children and, you know, asking them what their ideas were and how they got those ideas, and really opening up their minds politically.
Yes, Misty Turbeville, one of the central characters in the film, is a woman who grew up in Crawford, went away to school and graduate school, and returned to this town to raise her kids. And she is a very critical thinker and tries to teach the kids in her class to think for themselves, to not necessarily parrot their parents' political views. And the arrival of Bush, as she says, and as many of the kids in her class say, the arrival of Bush in Crawford really gives her an opportunity to direct their attention to current events. When the war starts to go south in 2004, 2005, and hundreds and thousands, literally, of protesters arrive in Crawford, many of the students current events become unavoidable when protesters are in your backyard. So Ms. Turbeville does use a sort of Socratic method to really get the kids to think about what's going on in their town.
There's also some footage, I mean, besides Cindy Sheehan, and we probably many of us who follow the news were aware of Cindy Sheehan's activities in Crawford, Texas. You also had something which maybe fewer of us know about, which is the Crawford Peace House.
Yes, the Peace House actually was in existence before Cindy Sheehan arrived in Crawford.
Right.
It's a little house not far from the single stoplight in town, and it was a place where some early protesters arrived and tried to establish a sort of counter voice to the Bush, the sort of Bush's presence in town. As they said, it was something to sort of balance it out. And when Cindy Sheehan arrived in the summer of 2005, having lost her son Casey in the Iraq War and having decided to come down to Crawford to try and meet personally with President Bush, she sort of used the Peace House as a place to launch her sort of larger campaign from. And when people started coming from around the country, sort of around this spark, the Peace House sort of became a place for them to stage their protests and a resource for them. You had on one Saturday in August of 2005, there were roughly 20,000 protesters and counter-protesters in this tiny 700-person town. There was nowhere to park. There was nowhere to go to the bathroom. And the Peace House, as well as the entire town of Crawford, was really overwhelmed with these protesters and really became ground zero in a national conflict.
We're talking to David Modigliani about the film Crawford, which is screening at the Santa Fe Film Festival later on this week. So as George Bush's popularity declined because of the war, there was also a corresponding decline ultimately in Crawford itself.
That's right. I think that after this initial boom we described of both an economic boom and a sort of thrill and excitement about Bush arriving, the protests really changed the image of the town. Cindy Sheehan, I think, to some degree, called President Bush's bluff. It was sort of, you know, if you are a folksy small town guy, you know, please lean over the fence and talk with me. And when he chose not to, and you'll see in the film these images of a huge caravan of SUVs driving right by her as she waits near his ranch, if you trace public opinion about the war back, that really was the turning point when the majority of the country came to feel that they were against the war. And after that happened, the image of Crawford changed from one of a sort of this bale of hay and piece of farm machinery that people had seen in the news stand-ups to one of conflict and protest. And after that, we see some of the local shop owners and a lot of the people in town experiencing a kind of economic bust as stores close down and tourist traffic really ebbs. Sort of following the downward spiral of the Bush administration and of Bush's presidency and popularity.
And the Little Crawford newspaper in 2004 endorsed John Kerry.
Yes, they had quite an experience themselves. This was a little newspaper in Crawford. They had endorsed President Bush in 2000, and in 2004 they made the decision to endorse Senator Kerry for the presidency. And as we hear in the film from the newspaper editor, he lost about half of his circulation in a week and most of his advertising. So this political statement led to basically a boycott of the paper in town. And we see that theme throughout the film, this notion kind of perpetuated, the with us or against us notion, where folks who become critical of the administration or of the policies laid out by the administration are really questioned in terms of their loyalty or their patriotism. And you begin to see a small town really become politicized along national lines in the same kind of divisive way that, that the country found itself.
What is Crawford, Texas like now?
I think Crawford is on its way back to a more normal place, but I think that things won't ever really be the same. I think they've gone through some pretty trying growing pains, and they will no longer be the center of attention, but they will forever be linked to President Bush. And the experience of sort of politicization and divisiveness that they experience as a result of Bush's presence there has left an imprint on the town that I don't think will go away anytime soon.
Have you shown this documentary to the people of Crawford?
We had a wonderful opportunity in June of this year to show Crawford in Crawford. We had the chance to bring a 50-foot inflatable outdoor screen and got permission to show the film on the high school football field in town. We had all of the characters in the film who really vary, politically speaking, across the political continuum and have very different journeys. Each of them have a very different journey through the Bush era. But all of them were there along with most of the town and many people from the surrounding area to watch this film on a beautiful summer night. And we filmed all of this, and it's actually a DVD extra. The DVDs that can on Amazon and also at CrawfordMovie.com, and you can see sort of the people in town's reaction to this film. It was pretty exciting for us to bring the film back there in a kind of neat way to sort of end of the cycle of the filmmaking process.
David Modigliani is the producer and director of the documentary Crawford, which screens this Thursday, the 4th of December, at 8:15 at the New Mexico Film Museum, and then again on Sunday at 3:15. David, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And once again, the Crawford the movie, CrawfordMovie.com is the website. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. I'd like now to welcome Philip Guzman. He is the director, writer, and producer of the film 222, which is screening at the Santa Fe Film Festival. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
Now, this is a great movie. This is one of my picks of the festival. It's a heist movie about four thieves who rob a hotel, but it's not a typical crime movie. It's actually about the characters. How did this film come about? How did the story come about?
Well, what wound up happening was Mick Ross, who actually co-wrote it with me, we met up at a film festival in Hollywood, and he had a film called Play It Out, and we had a film called Lawless, and they were, you know, it was similar kind of, you know, I guess, films, and the fact that we did it for very little money, and we put a lot of heart and soul into it, and they're both crime films, and so we kind of hit it off right off the bat, and he came up to me and goes, hey, you know, saw the film, loved the film, and I have an idea for a heist flick that takes place in the wintertime, but it'd be about the characters, and it'd be about the actual events themselves and how it, you know, interacts with the characters. And so he gave me a little bit more information on it, and sure enough, he introduced me to his producer, Lenny Batondo, who actually wound up producing the film. And within the next, you know, 2 to 3 weeks, we were already in San Antonio writing the screenplay for it.
And he ended up being one of the actors in it.
Mick Ross, yeah, he's an amazing actor. He's the lead in the film. And he's actually, he was kind of the centerpiece of putting together this whole project. He had so many contacts with the actors. Like, almost the entire acting corps came out of Los Angeles. All the crew came from all my guys here in Texas. And we all pretty much met up in Toronto to shoot the movie. So it was a little bit of a weird little triangle there.
It's well, that was something I wanted to ask you, because the actors are amazing both individually and in ensemble, and it's very much of an ensemble piece. How did you put them, well, you and Mick Rossi, put this group together? I mean, the chemistry among them is really a major part of how the whole film works.
That was something that we took into account. Like, each one of these characters, the roles are written specifically for them. Like, pretty much, I mean, Mick has so many talented friends out there. And, like, he brought Robert Miano in, who plays Willie, who is really, I mean, he's quite, you know, he's kind of the heart of the movie. He plays the older character. He's such a good actor. He's been in everything. He was in Donnie Brasco with Al Pacino. And, you know, it's a lot of great actors that you recognize. Like, you'll see him and go, oh, I know that guy's face. And, you know, not quite sure where you put him. Like, almost everybody in this film's like that. And, you know, it was fun. I mean, everyone was so talented, and they really had an on-screen and off-screen relationship. We were like a big family. We all hang out, and it shows on screen that, you know, they're very close to one another.
So what was the rehearsal process like? Did you rehearse for quite a while?
No, we like to keep it kind of fresh and experience the moment when it happens on screen. So we would pretty much, we'd go through daily, you know, what we were going to be doing. We didn't have like a full sit down, you know, where everyone reads through it. It becomes a little bit, you know, I guess laborious at that time when you start doing too much rehearsal. So what we would do to keep it really fresh, you know, we'd go through pretty much just, you know, the basis of what the scene, you know, what we're trying to say in the scene. And from there, that's where you really trust your actors and your cinematographer to really capture the essence of what the scene's supposed to be. And so it was pretty fresh. You know, we didn't do too many takes. It made it a little bit difficult as far as shooting goes because there's four main characters. So every scene we had to shoot four times.
Right. We're talking to Philip Guzman, director, writer, and producer of the film 222. I find myself wondering when I watch films like this, is that how do filmmakers and actors who are essentially artists know so much about crime and about lowlifes?
I guess you can say, I guess the real term on that one, okay, let me see here. What's the right way to answer that? I was a criminal justice major before I switched over to being a filmmaker. I was studying that for 4 years, and you know, and I think we all have a fascination with the darker side of just people. I guess it's just interesting, and so I'd studied criminal justice for a long time, and I was really fascinated with psychology and what makes people do, you know, devious things and whatnot. And it just kind of, it's always been my favorite genre of film as well. I mean, I can, you know, ever since I was a kid, I've always loved a good, you know, crime film or even a good Western, something that has a little bit of I don't know, violence or something, but not so much for the violence, but for the emotion that follows it, you know?
Right. Well, and it's interesting because the film is dark and it's funny at the same time. And as I was watching it, I was really thinking that there's an art to using just enough humor in a film without too much.
Right. And what we did with this film that was, I mean, key to, I think, making it work is we wanted to portray, you know, these group of thieves as, you know, a lot of movies like you watch, like, you know, say like an Ocean's 11 movie. They sit there and they glorify, you know, they sit there and plan the entire movie out into some huge elaborate scheme. But when it comes down to it, it's like these guys, it's their day job, you know. They don't ever talk about what it is they're going to go do because it's like working at Burger King or anything else. It's like you go to work and that's what you do. You don't sit there and, you know, strategize how you're going to work today. And that's what we really tried to focus on. And so it really allows the characters to just be themselves because it takes the pressure off of the heist. It allows them to be who they are in the moments because that's what's important to this film, you know. It allows, you know, Willie to say some jokes or, you know, Finn's character to have, you know, a good time, you know, heckling Willie or, you know, even Gail's character. So, you know, it really allowed for a lot of freedom to have, you know, a little bit of comedy in there because it wasn't so intense on, you know, at this time this happens, at that time that happens, because we felt that's been done a million times.
Right. That's interesting. Well, it's also, I mean, one of the other things that was interesting about it, I thought, was that even in crime, there are rules, and you break them at your own peril. And it's the breaking of those rules that leads the movie to its conclusion.
Yeah, exactly. There's definitely, I mean, I don't want to give too much away here or anything.
Right.
There's definitely, you know, things you shouldn't do and things you should do. And there's definitely a little bit of, I guess, a criminal dogma that you must follow. I mean, and if you go outside those rules, either you get in trouble with your own kind or you get in trouble with the police, you know. So it's a very fine line you have to walk there. And without giving anything away, of course.
Right. Now, I just have to say that Val Kilmer has a part, our own New Mexico actor, and it's a pretty small but very kind of weird and twisted part that he has.
Yeah, he's actually, he and Mick are very good friends, and they play music together. They're amazing. And, yeah, I was fortunate enough to get to direct Val, and he came in, and he was a pleasure to work with, and we gave him kind of a quirky character called, his name's Maz, and he's a jewelry fence. And he has a very unusual way, like, he doesn't just take stolen goods and sell them. He's so meticulous, and so, like, you know, he almost thinks too much into everything to where he actually takes every piece of jewelry and recuts it into something different so it can never be traced back.
That's right.
And when he got his sides, he was like, well, this is kind of interesting, you know? And the only way we could really, I guess, explain it would be like to be like a super neurotic Phil Spector, you know, somebody who's just, you know, just on edge at all times. And he just really embraced it and he kind of went for it. And he did an amazing job.
What are some of the influences of other films that you drew on to make this film, 222?
Oh, well, Mick and I are both huge fans of, you know, 70s-style crime films. Anything back from, you know, Dog Day Afternoon, Serpico, French Connection, The Long Good Friday, lots of movies that were, you know, because those movies weren't about the spectacle of the crime. It wasn't about, you know, going down the street with machine guns and blowing up everything in sight. It was more so about, you know, just good story, good acting, focus on the characters and focus on, you know, the situation at hand versus, you know, all of a sudden, you know, some huge event happens and that's what you focus on is the event. So we really wanted to, you know, stray from that and, you know, keep it more of a heartfelt story than, you know, I guess like a big action flick.
So you are a young filmmaker. You're still in your 20s. How did you get your start, and how did you start making these amazing movies so soon out of film school?
I'm reasonably young. I guess I have a lot of gray hair already, but I'm 28 now, and I went to film school at Stephen F. Austin, and that's where I met the other fellow. His name's Philip Roy, and he's the cinematographer and editor of the film, and we've been working together since our first day in film school. And pretty much right out of college, we had a little bit of a gap where we were like, well, we've got a little bit of money. Either we can, you know, hold out and just save our money and go get, you know, real jobs besides filmmaking, and then maybe see if someone will help us out down the road. And we decided to go the other way and just take every penny we had and invest it into a movie, which is it's called The Lawless, and that actually comes out December 16th. And it's a cool flick, and that's how I met, you know, Mick and Lenny, and you know, it's, a lot of good things have come from that project. It's a really cool, it's a gritty crime film as well, and we shot that one for $7,000 about a year and a half ago. And it's been a lot of fun with that movie. So
what kind of a budget did you have for this one? I mean, this is still an independent film.
It is an independent film, and all I can say on that, because that's actually one of those things, you know, you can't really ever talk too much about that, but I can say that it's less than 10, but more than 1. If that was a coded enough answer for you.
Well, I have to say, Philip Roy is an amazing cinematographer and editor. My friend who was watching it with me and I commented on that, and we're really, you know, jolted and moved by the editing itself. It's a terrific film. It's called 222, and it screens on Thursday, the 4th of December, at the DeVargas 2 at 11 in the morning, and then once again on Saturday at the DeVargas 2 here in Santa Fe at 9 in the evening. Philip Guzman is the director, writer, and producer of the film. I want to thank you so much for being with us here on KSFR.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to take a little break right now. We will be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like to welcome Carolyn Travis. She is co-producer and co-director of the film Airplay, The Rise and Fall of Rock Radio, which is screening at the Santa Fe Film Festival. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you. I'm Mary Charlotte.
So this is a wonderful, long, interesting documentary. It's such a relatively short time ago, but when rock radio began, American culture was so different from the way it is now, including segregation of all kinds in music and in the media. Tell us about this time and about the first rock DJs.
Well, originally, you know, they were segregated stations. You couldn't hear Little Richard or Fats Domino on mainstream white stations, so they had these black stations. But, you know, kids, the children of the 50s were the first generation of teenagers, and they wanted something of their own, and they started getting turned on to this R&B music. And originally, there were white DJs, these middle-aged, very straight-looking men who were playing this music on these mainstream stations at night. Late at night, usually. And some of these stations, like WLAC in Nashville, had a 50,000-watt capability. So at night, you could hear them all over the country. So it started catching on. And then, of course, Alan Freed was the breakout mainstream DJ in the 50s in Cleveland.
You had, at this time, white artists like Pat Boone covering music by black artists, but in some way, I mean, we think of this as a whitewashing of black music or a ripoff, but in some ways, as it comes out in the movies, this really served to narrow the gap between black and white.
Well, he said, you know, no one would have heard, Pat said to us, no one would have heard these songs on the mainstream stations if he hadn't covered them, and yes, it did, because He said he understood why kids liked Little Richard's version of Tutti Frutti better than his, but they may have gotten turned on to the song through him.
So the hunger for this music and for the dancing that went with it were very great. But there was also an opposition, even record burnings. It's quite amazing to see this.
Well, you know, this was pre-segregated. This was, especially in the South, it was terrible because there was a big black and white divide, and there was a lot of, you know, there was still time in the 50s. You still had white and black lunch counters and white and black restrooms in a lot of the country. And, yes, there was. In fact, we have two record burnings in the show. I think we have an early one that we talk about, and then there's also one where they burned Beatle records because when John Lennon said that they were bigger than Jesus.
That's
so there's
right.
There's always been somebody trying to shut down rock and roll, but just it never worked.
Meanwhile, the music on the radio spilled over into dancing, and there were some events DJed by these radio DJs that were gigantic dance events, and one of them even resulted in a riot and was shut down.
Yeah, Alan Freed had a couple of those. There was one in Cleveland that was really a little pre-rock and roll, I think 53, and then there was one in Boston where, you know, kids were trampled because they oversold the show. But, you know, every DJ, in every city there was one DJ that had a TV dance show and that came out and did these concerts. And it was just so new that everybody wanted to be a part of it. And it really wasn't the kids so much as, you know, just the way the venues were set up then. They just weren't ready for it. They weren't ready for the kind of crowds they were going to get for a show like that.
So rock radio caught on to such an extent that record labels started paying DJs to play their songs, and this resulted in congressional hearings about payola. But this was complicated because the fact was that there were politicians who were really trying to suppress the whole culture of rock in the first place.
Well, also, it came right on the heels of the quiz show investigations, or TV, where they came away empty-handed. They really ended up getting nothing. And it was an election year, and they were looking for something that would get voters. And rock and roll was just such a great target. And because really, it wasn't the payola wasn't really illegal then. It was just not declaring it on your taxes.
Right.
I think New York was the only state that had any laws regarding payola, but it was just the fact that they didn't declare the income. And they just went after them. It was like a witch hunt.
And the real issue was that there was this irrepressible youth culture.
Yes. Like I said, it was the first generation of teenagers that had their own style, their own music, their own everything. And it was a time in the country where it was peaceful. The 50s were peaceful, and there was prosperity after the war. And these kids had money to go out and buy the records and buy the concert tickets. So it just kept growing and growing.
Meanwhile, AM radio kind of devolved into Top 40. What was that whole process about?
Well, Top 40 really started before payola, but it got more important after payola because the stations were afraid of losing their licenses, so they would take away the DJ's freedom to pick music and have program directors and have these playlists that were out there. And it was mostly a result of payola. And it just got more and more, less and less creative. And then what happened was there was a ruling in 1966 that AM and FM stations could no longer simulcast because these FM stations that a lot of these AM stations owned were making no money. No one even had FM radios. You know, very few people had them in those days. So there were these FM frequencies that were just kind of simulcasting what was on the AM station or doing nothing, and they started having to do something original on the FM stations, and that's when they would hire these college kids for next to nothing, and they'd bring in their own albums, and they'd, you know, they had almost no sponsors, so they could just do what they wanted, and that's how FM, you know, that's how FM really got its start. And then there was, of course, Tom Donahue, who was an AM DJ who had been a victim of payola and gone out to San Francisco and just was tired of all the bubblegum music and started underground radio in San Francisco.
We're talking to Carolyn Travis about the film Airplay, The Rise and Fall of Rock Radio, which is screening at the Santa Fe Film Festival. It's so refreshing to see this film and to hear the sound of FM in the 60s and 70s. There was so much freedom, and people played the most amazing mixes of music and even, you know, moments from clips from films. They played album cuts instead of singles. And this got bigger than just college stations.
Oh, yeah. College stations, well, see, what happened, the first generation of kids that grew up with rock and roll went to college, and then when they got there, they decided they wanted to do something creative, and by that time, FM was starting to take hold, and stereo, and they wanted to play the album cuts, but it really was, it took over, I think New York and San Francisco were the first really big markets to do it, and a lot of the AM DJs crossed over, and then, of course, there were the young kids that came in on it. And it just got huge. I mean, we had DJs tell us they could get on the air and say there's an anti-war rally in Golden Gate Park or whatever, and they could get 100,000 kids to show up.
It's, I mean, the power of radio in those days, and really in any day, is quite amazing. Even in the early era, there was a very cute story in the film about how there was a traffic jam on Long Island, and one of the DJs said, wave to the person in the next car, and next thing you know, two of those people who waved to each other were getting married.
Yeah, there are a lot of those. In fact, we're doing a website in a few months called theairplaychannel.com that's going to have a lot of the stories, a lot of the interviews that we didn't have time for, because it's hard to get 50 years into 90 minutes.
Indeed. But even with FM radio, there was the pressure of corporations and consultants and program managers and so on the DJs, and FM also had its sort of rise and fall.
Yes, because as soon as it got popular and as soon as it started making money, businesses got interested in it. And then they started taking it over, and then there are very few. I mean, today there are a handful of DJs maybe that still play what they – one guy on our show, Jim Ladd, will still go on the air at night and play anything he wants, and he's an artist. I mean, if he – you listen to his songs and you can see how one links to the other. I mean, he just creates this whole scenario with his music, and – very few of them get to do that. We were going into the stations to do interviews, and everything was on computer, and all the DJs got to do was push a button.
Well, you know where you still get to do that is public radio stations, even like this one. There's incredibly
creative
music. Yes,
we know. You're the lucky ones.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, public radio is really what FM radio was 30, 40 years ago.
Yes, and that's why it's so important.
So there's this kind of narrative arc from AM radio to FM radio to satellite. Do you feel that satellite is really carrying on that spirit of creativity?
Well, we're hoping. The merger happened in the middle of our edit. So
the
we were
XM
kind of
Sirius.
Hedging our bets a little. So that's going to be something that we're going to address on the website more. But I know XM has their classic music stations. They have every song that's on a CD, and they have a humongous library. And in the beginning, at least, they have the freedom to play the songs they want, and there's not this, you know, like most radio stations have a playlist of maybe 50 or 60 songs. They have hundreds. We're hoping that they're allowed to keep doing that, because there's no FCC regulation on satellite.
Right. I mean, the satellite that I've heard, and to be sure, different genres than the one you're talking about, don't have, you hope and wish that they do, but they just don't have that creativity that you're talking about.
Well, now that there's a merger, I think they kind of handpicked the best from both sides. Because there are a lot, when we went to XM, like for instance, the reggae station was run by someone who had played with Bob Marley. And there were really people who loved the music. It wasn't a job for them, it was a passion. And we're kind of hoping that those people stick around and that more of them come on board. Because they do, you know, there are towns, I mean, Santa Fe is a big market and where I live in Miami is, but there are towns all around the country where there is no classical station or no classic rock station or no jazz station, and the only way they get this kind of music is through satellite.
The film that you made, the documentary Airplay, The Rise and Fall of Rock Radio, is very creative in its use of visuals. You use black and white during the AM part of the movie and color during the FM part of the movie. Even the contemporary interviews are in black and white during the first half of the movie. And then you apply color in this really cool way, like there's just splotches of red and yellow and blue, and there's also all sorts of archival footage and footage from the early days of radio. A huge job in assembling all of that.
Well, my husband was really the main editor, and all the cute color in the black and white footage. My husband Chris Gilson did all of that, and the archival was me, because I was one of those kids that really grew up with a transistor radio under her pillow at night, and I'll tell you a really quick, funny story. The reason when I decided to do this is because I wanted to meet my DJs. I wanted to meet the guys that I listened to as a child. And Cousin Brucey, who's in the show, was one of my favorites. And I knew he had done shows in Palisades Park where he and his dog had matching outfits. So I wrote him a letter, and I said I wasn't lucky enough to grow up in New York or go to Palisades Park, but my dog and I have matching sweaters. And he called me, and I said, this is a sign I need to do this show.
Right.
But the archival was, it's amazing. None of these DJs had footage of themselves.
Really?
I don't know why. That was the hardest part, finding footage of these people.
Right. Very interesting. Well, the film is called Airplay, The Rise and Fall of Rock Radio, and it screens here at the Santa Fe Film Festival at 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 4th of December, and again at 8 o'clock on Sunday at Tipton Hall on the campus of the College of Santa Fe. Carolyn Travis is the co-producer and co-director of the film. And what is the website if people want to go and find out more about your film?
Well, right now our website is www.travesty, which is TRAVISTY.TV. And then they can go on that and find out when our new website, theairplaychannel.com, is going to launch, because that's a pretty big job. We're still putting that together.
Carolyn Travis, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a little break. We'll be right back. I would like to welcome Zach Schaefer and Steve Saporito. They are filmmakers whose film Squeeze Box is screening at the Santa Fe Film Festival. It won the jury award at the Philadelphia International Gay and Lesbian Film Festival for Best Documentary. And I have to say, it's one of my two picks for Best Documentary that I've seen so far at the Santa Fe Film Festival. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you so much.
So this is a film about a gay rock club in New York called Squeeze Box. It was a weekly phenomenon from 1994 to 2001. How did Squeeze Box come about? What was the concept?
Zach, you want to do it?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Basically, there were two friends. One of them worked at a place called Don Hills, and his name was Patrick Briggs, and he was talking to his good friend, Michael Schmidt. And they were kind of throwing around what would be a fun party to have that was just not available in New York at the time. And Patrick said, whatever we do, we can do here at Don Hills. And the two of them came up with this idea to have a gay rock and roll party. And, of course, there would be DJs that would spin. But what would make the party unique in their mind was they would ask all the local New York City drag queens to sing rock and roll covers, but they wouldn't allow them to lip sync. They would make them sing live with their own voices. And that's how it started, and through that little thing, it just became a popular rock and roll spot in New York City in the 90s where a lot of bands would play. And even though it was a gay rock and roll party, it was definitely a very mixed atmosphere.
And the really interesting thing that they did was they brought together a house band so that instead of singing to tracks, they had a band performing, and the drag queens had to get up there and just belt it out in front of a live band, which brought in that whole, you know, sort of live element. It can't be so rehearsed that it's stale. It was just something that was like live and exciting and rock and roll.
I find it so interesting that until then, there were a lot of drag queens who loved rock and roll, but they didn't really admit to it because, you know, rock, heavy metal was the music of homophobic guys, and they were supposed to be doing Judy Garland covers. So Squeezebox was really kind of a musical, cultural coming together that hadn't happened before.
I think that there was some underpinning for it in New York City. There had been a scene at the Pyramid Club where you kind of got that rock and roll vibe thrown in with the drag vibe, but it was more of performance art than, you know, a straight ahead rock and roll. When Squeezebox came along, it just discarded the fact that we need to put it in a pretext or a context, and just said, we're just going to go straight ahead and do this as real rock and roll. I think that was the defining line for what was going on there.
Yeah, and as all the queens and more talk about in the film, a lot of that inspiration also came from Jane County, who had been around New York and when we were making the film, we interviewed everybody about her, and we really tried to get it in the film that she was a real inspiration for a lot of these people, and that gay rock and roll, while very marginalized in a lot of ways before, it did exist, and a lot of it was with her.
Tell us more about Jane County.
Oh, boy, what do you want to know?
Well, I'll do this one. Jane County started out life as Wayne County from a small town in Georgia. Came up at the middle end of the Warhol scene, was a DJ at Max's Kansas City, and really was the first person who performed rock and roll and drag. I mean, Jane was an all-out rock and roller who had no problem presenting herself as at that time as a drag queen who rocked. Started a band called the Electric Chairs, which was one of the seminal punk bands of New York City, and really had been on the scene for a long time, staying very true to her rock and roll roots. I think that she was an inspiration to most everybody who went to Squeeze Box. And if you had never heard of her before you walked in, she performed there enough that you really got to fall in love with her.
Yeah. We're talking about the film Squeeze Box. And Steve, you were there, well, I guess you were both there from the beginning. I guess the first night had maybe 50 people, and it grew like crazy from then on. What was the scene like? What was it like to be in this club?
It was.
Go ahead, Steve.
You can add. It was amazing in that once it hit, and it took a little, about a month or so, and once it hit, it was this jam-packed night of every kind of person that you wanted to meet. And that was the exciting thing about it. It wasn't just about posers posing or people trying to be outrageous. It was people trying to be outrageous, college kids, all different types, and the diversity of the crowd and the diversity of the performers, because they, besides the drag queens performing, they would always have a rock band perform, either a local act or a medium-sized touring act. Bands like Imperial Teen played there, and it was just a complete evening, because you had Mistress from Micah was the MC, and there would be this sort of comedy about it, and then there would be, the bands would perform, and then you'd get the drag queens, which could be just sort of straight-ahead rock and roll, or this sort of infusion of kind of comedy and rock and roll. If you saw the film The Dueling Bankheads, doing the Flock of Seagulls telecommunication, I think, is a really fine example of where it might not be a technically brilliant performance, but it is a brilliant performance and really enjoyable. And I think that's what it is. It was that great sort of mix of everybody who was around at the time joining together to have a fun time.
Yeah, and one of the things that was fun about making the movie for Steve and I was that I actually was not there in the beginning. I was not a regular of the club. Steve went to the first one and was there, I think, pretty consistently for the first couple, 2 or 3 years. And then I didn't even move to New York until 1996. And I went there because a friend of mine that I went to college with was a member of a band called the Toilet Boys. And I went to go see him play. And I don't know that I ever would have otherwise gone to Squeeze Box. It wasn't really, at the time, something that attracted me. I mean, when I first moved to New York, I was like the kid waiting in line to see Rent, and and so I went, and I was just I walked in, and it terrified me, and I loved it, and I kept going back, and it was something that at the time I didn't even know I wanted, but once I started going, realized exactly how much I wanted it in my life, and then ended up making a movie about it, which is even crazier.
Well, I love that everyone was welcome, gay and straight and drag and not drag, as long as they were tolerant, and the intolerant were not tolerated.
That's a very good way of putting it, and
yeah,
that's exactly right.
That's
the
exactly
intolerant
correct.
Were thrown out of the club, and as Jackie Beat says, they were often thrown out by the drag queens themselves.
It's such a great combination. We're talking about the film Squeezebox, of in this club, the most hardcore, you know, sex and drugs and rock and roll and total outrageousness on the one hand, and then at the same time, the politics of liberation and tolerance and creating a great extended family that in the movie seems, I mean, I guess I wouldn't quite use the word wholesome, but something like that.
It is. It's a twisted wholesomeness to the place. It took on a very family-like atmosphere, but it was kind of like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre family. You know, the most twisted, wildest, craziest things happened there, but you could go there and do them and not feel ridiculed for doing them, and you could feel safe, and you could really be as wildly expressive as you wanted to be.
I think the great thing about it was that it allowed you to try things that you maybe secretly always wanted to try but never had the platform or the ability to do. And it wasn't so much about the succeeding but the trying that was applauded there. So you didn't have to feel that if you went up there to perform and it didn't go that well, that people were going to ridicule you. Quite the opposite. People were going to encourage you to maybe do it again and find what was good and really try and push that forward. And that is really unusual, especially in a place like New York.
Now, the outfits that people wore were so creative that famous designers actually came to Squeezebox to get inspired.
Yes, they did. And that is something we talk about in the film. But, you know, in all honesty, famous designers go to a lot of clubs around the world to get inspired. And certainly in New York at that time, Squeezebox was one of the places they went.
Now, you have footage going way back, lots of interviews with people involved in the club. Tell us about the process of putting the film together. It's brilliantly edited.
Well, thank you very much. And that, we have to give a huge shout out to Sean Pierce, our editor. He was an incredible editor, and not only did he do the editing, he also did all the motion graphics, which, if you've seen the movie, you realize really add to the whole fabric and look and experience of watching the film. And it was a very communal process between myself and Steve and Sean for quite some time to come up with that, because there was a lot of footage, and the editing, it goes pretty quickly, but it... Hopefully it doesn't feel like it goes too quick or too slow.
I think the most rewarding thing about the whole process itself was the way everybody who had been there responded to us, whether it was John Waters or Debbie Harry or Michael Cunningham or just the people, the regulars who went, who freely gave like their video, the pictures, most of the pictures that you see are people's personal snapshots of the club. The video, I mean, it was the mid-late 90s, so video was freely available, and there was a lot of it to be had. And you know, we put it out there that we were doing the film, and the response from people, because they loved the club so much. And we got a lot of support from Michael Schmidt, who really stood behind us. And, you know, it takes a long time to make an independent documentary, and he never lost faith in us, and he always was, whenever we needed something, he was always there to you know, help and support us, and always put the word out to people that, you know, they should cooperate with us. And that was, for me, the greatest part, was people so willing to give of themselves to be part of the whole process of making this film.
One of the narrative threads in the film is the efforts on the part of the Rudy Giuliani administration to really shut down the sex clubs and other parts of the nightlife in New York City. How did that affect Squeezebox?
Well, I think in a lot of ways it actually made Squeezebox more popular and more prominent, and more of a place to go. A lot of places like Squeezebox especially performance venues, were being targeted and closed down. And as more of the sex clubs started to close down, you know, at the time where Squeezebox was located, it was pretty remote and pretty not hard to find, but off the beaten path as far as the cops were concerned. And Don Hill, the owner of the club himself, he really made such an effort to know his neighbors and respond to his neighbors' complaints and go about the right way of dealing with the cops and the fire department and all of those people. A lot of the reason that Squeezebox wasn't closed in that time, they were raided, and they were certainly not left alone, but the reason they weren't closed was because of the efforts of Don Hill himself and their location. And as the city was changing, it kind of became this beacon of old New York ranch that stayed alive.
Well, the film is called Squeezebox. It won the jury award at the Philadelphia International Gay and Lesbian Film Festival for Best Documentary. Zach Schaefer and Steve Saporito are the filmmakers. Thank you both so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary
Charlotte.
Thank
you.
And the film screens at 8:15 on Thursday, December 4th at the Forum on the campus of the College of Santa Fe, and once again at 8:15 on Saturday, December 6th. And you can find out more about the film at myspace.com/thesqueezeboxmovie. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Nick Iapolucci for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience. All this week, coverage of the Santa Fe Film Festival, so keep your dial tuned to KSFR. Hasta la vista. Ciao.